Hey, before, well, Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Yeah.
Thank Jeffrey you. Weiss, folks, a political prof at DMACC, and we're going to talk about whether America needs a divorce or simply marriage counseling. Jeffrey has a proposal he's been giving presentations on, and he's here to share that with you, and I'm here to rip it apart. maybe not. Okay. But anyway, before we talk about that, we got to talk about robots, okay? Just briefly, robots. Because now they're getting into food delivery. So in some parts of the U.S., they take Los Angeles, for example. Coco Robotics is now operating 1,000 street-level delivery robots, and they use the sidewalk. And I'm wondering whether that's legal for an electrical vehicle to move, use the sidewalk. But the company plans to open 10,000 units. So I'm wondering, how do delivery workers feel about it? And in one story I read, Julia Ruggiero, she's a delivery worker. She says, quote, "I used to make about 5 deliveries an hour. Now I'm lucky to get 3. I have to drive for Lyft just as, you know, in order to get by." So it's not just sidewalk robots. It's drones as well. Walmart apparently is using drones to deliver food in Atlanta and Charlotte. Where else? Houston, Orlando, Tampa. And it's not just here in the U.S. I got to share, before we talk, Jeffrey, I got to share a promotional clip from a AI company in Shenzhen, China. Check this out.
Across town, near a university campus, students gather around another delivery point. It's clear this isn't new to them. They already know where to go, how to scan, how to grab their order, and head to class. No waiting, no talking to anyone, no stress.
I love that. No talking to anyone, because, you know, talking to people is very stressful, Jeffrey, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, I don't know how stressful talking is, but we're going to start on.
All I can do is
it.
Just start singing Sticks, Mr. Roboto.
So, right, Mr. Roboto, sure. Yep. But, you know, on Reddit, there's a very fascinating post about shooting down drones. This is only in America would you hear have this conversation. Discussion about what the best guns are for shooting down drones that are carrying food that just happen to stray across your property. Because that is your property, after all. And you have a right to shoot down anything above it.
Stand your
ground. Not really, you don't. But there are some people who seem to think you do. So, anyway, this all comes at a time when Trump is proposing, they got a plan, I'll call it, called Winning the AI Race. And it's really taken a bite out of what states can do to regulate AI, and causing a lot of concerns among those who believe that there ought to be ways of managing the whole situation as we move forward into this very brave unknown world. Speaking of unknown worlds, Jeffrey, you have a proposal that I would love to discuss. You think it's time for America to have a divorce?
Yeah, I wrote an essay, Why the United States Needs a Divorce, in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, in the Declaration of Independence, wrote a right of revolution, in particular, if a form of government no longer works. And the United States is late for the party. What I mean by that is, and I've said this many times, that if you study presidential republics, they tend to be governments that end up becoming executive dictatorships.
How many do we have in the world right now? Just 2, right?
There are, a number of presidential republics. There's probably, I don't know, I'm thinking 70 to 90
really,
in the world.
Oh, really, that many?
Yeah. The continent of Africa is populated with presidential republics. So is South America. And
where did my 2 figure come from? I thought there were 2 that were actually working well.
The 2 that work the best are Uruguay and Costa Rica.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And there are a number of presidential republics in South America that collapsed under military and executive dictatorship, Argentina, Brazil, et cetera, in the 70s and 80s. But unlike the United States, these countries have constitutions that can be changed, and they have allowed their governments, in fact, to, for example, introduce things like proportional representation voting in when they vote for their version of the House of Representatives. And unfortunately, the United States has a constitution that is nearly impossible to change. The other thing I would say just quickly, then I'll go for it. The United States is a country of 340 million people, and it is very diverse. And a presidential republic, especially one with plurality, winner-take-all voting, is just the worst form of government for a very diverse country. The United States has one more political party than China does. And what we have in many states, and we even have it in the national government right now, is a one-party state. Because checks and balances don't mean a lot if one party controls all three branches.
Right.
And so if you are in California and you are a member of the Republican Party, you're effectively disenfranchised. If you are in Iowa and you're a member of the Democratic Party, you're effectively disenfranchised. And if you live in the United States of America, where we have one party now that controls all three branches of government, and that one party is now authoritarian and has given up on the American experiment, you have a situation where, at least half of the population is, experiences some version of no taxation and no representation.
I don't think anybody would disagree with your analysis. There's probably some people who would, but I think for the most part, people understand that we are not functioning well. Maybe that's an understatement. Maybe people would say that we are actually dysfunctional. What is your solution?
What I thought about was to break up the country on either side of the Mississippi. 365-day transition, the presidential republic, everything would be completely dissolved. The two camps would be the only two camps I can think of that could at least be the people who would lead the people to a side of the Mississippi. The Republicans can lead a group to one side, the Democrats can lead a group to the other side. Now, of course, at least 40 to 50% of the population doesn't like either party. So that those people will need to decide who to follow. But because this current government will be dissolved, it will be up to the two factions on either side of the Mississippi to completely start from scratch. The borders will be secured, the river, whatever we need to do. But the reality is then the people sort of on the right in the United States can form whatever they want. I mean, if they want a Christian theocratic state, they can have it. If the people, more to the center or center left want to build something more like Norway, some kind of a social democracy, you have about 65 or 70% of Democratic base right now is considered to be sort of socialist or democratic socialist or wanting a social market economy. There's no way they can probably get to that in our current situation. So they could create something like that. And people would be able to live with the people that, to be honest with you, they always wanted to live with. I mean, if we're honest about the United States of America, we only have been a little bit of a democracy since 1965. That's not a long time, from 1789.
The Civil Rights Act.
Yeah,
the Voting Rights
exactly,
Act.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and really, if we're honest about it, even now we don't have one person, one vote. I mean, Jimmy Carter famously saying, the Carter Center doesn't monitor United States national elections because the United States doesn't even fulfill the minimum requirements for being a democratic country.
So let me ask you this.
And I don't know what we do about that. We can't change the Electoral College. We can't change the undemocratic composition of the Senate.
I want to get back to that because I disagree with that. But who gets the west half of the Mississippi? Who gets the east half?
I think just a simple coin flip would work. Somebody will end up with Florida. Somebody will end up with California. And, in terms of thinking about this idea, there might be other ways to do it. I know some people have said when I've talked about it, they said maybe some north-south thing with no shooting, of course. And this is going to be amicable. I mean, everybody can hug. They can shake hands. They can kiss each other on the cheek.
Amicable divorce.
Yeah, it'll be an amicable divorce.
Between 340 million people.
Absolutely. I think it's really the best way that that both peoples would have some kind of sort of life, liberty, in the pursuit of happiness. Because I feel as if when I look forward and I look at our form of government, our form of voting, corporations are people, money is speech. When I look at the very basic parameters for what both the so-called right and the so-called left agree with, getting money out of elections, etc., and you really don't see a way forward, then this would be a way where people could start from scratch and they could build whatever they want. And like I said, frankly, they can live with the people who they want to live with.
So who gets the east half of the country?
Like I said, that a coin flip.
Okay, so if I'm either one of those two sides and I win the coin flip, I'm going to be on the west. And you know why? Upwind. So we'll get to send all of our toxins to the east, all of our wildfire smoke, all of the coal fire power plants we build along the right descending bank of the Mississippi River. All that smoke's going to go to the east side of the country. The eastern U.S., whatever you want to call it. And you'll have no recourse because we can do whatever we want. We're our own country now, and we know where the air flows. And also there's a bunch of water. I mean, what about the Missouri River that flows in the Mississippi River? Well, we don't. What if we really don't care that we're going to be putting a lot of trash in there? I mean, how do you who's going to lose the flip and get the east side?
Once again, I mean that all of these things can be worked out or not.
Well, yeah, is a big deal.
Yeah, after there's two separate countries. Maybe one country can sue the other in the world court over such matters that you're talking about. I mean, it does happen in international law where there are border disputes over water. There's border disputes over,
Well, we see how well border disputes are being resolved in Ukraine, Russia, Israel, Palestine, Cambodia, Thailand. To pick your, 12 different, how many countries in Africa?
Yeah.
Are in some kind of war?
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's not going very
well. Yeah. But in fairness to many of those countries in Africa, they didn't draw their borders.
That was European.
Yeah, they were drawn artificially by, and in here, in my example, they're not drawn artificially. It's, both sides can agree on, these things. It might take a while, but, the general idea is that the country has reached an impasse and will be long dead. Our children will be long dead, and we will continue with Supreme Court justices for life. We'll continue with two parties in what will look like continually a one-party state. We will continue with money billionaires not only buying our elections but controlling our universities and controlling our media, controlling our information system. I mean, the Soviet Union had the Communist Party. We have a corporate oligarchy that operates in much the same way. So this is a way that we could start anew. And like I said, people could live with the people they want to live with in the first place.
What if I'm married? What if I'm a Democrat married to a Republican?
That's something that you'll need to figure out. You will need to figure that out. You'll have to make the argument to your wife or your significant other or whomever, but that's what will have to be figured out. People will have to choose either side and go from there. I mean, I'm not saying that mine is the only one. Maybe there's other people out there, and I'd like to hear from them too, that have ideas of maybe the way something like this could happen within states, maybe some states secede and things like that, that's also a possibility.
Well, one more question before we run to a break here. So you said it will take 365 days to establish these two new republics.
To disassemble everything else.
That's incredibly fast, by the way.
Yeah.
And so what triggers that decision? Who decides? Do you have a national vote? Is it a decision by some strong-arm president, for example? Or what's your mechanism for how that kicks off?
Well, I think I will be the strong-arm president.
Really? President Wise? We finally have a wise man president.
On behalf of this essay, I will certainly get the ball rolling.
Okay.
Obviously, I think all your audience knows. I mean, a little or maybe a lot of this is tongue in cheek in terms of it actually happening, but I also would say that in terms of some people that I've spoken to about this, the discussion itself has drawn a conversation with people about really where we're going and what this is going to look like 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. And is there any way out of this, or are we going to live in illiberalism for the rest of our lives and for our children's lives? And I don't know the answer to that
question. Great moment for a break. Oh, I got to take a short break. I want to come back and pick up where we left off on that. That's a great question. Folks, I'm talking to Jeffrey Weiss, a political psi prof at DMAC, Des Moines Area Community College. All right, my guest first half of the program, Jeffrey Weiss, and we've been talking about Jeffrey's proposal to dissolve the United States. He's calling it a divorce, to basically form two new republics, one on the west side of the Mississippi River, one on the east side of the Mississippi River, basically Republicans on one side, Democrats on another, independents go wherever they want to go. And before we dig into that, again, I have, just so you know, folks, I have some real problems with this, and Jeffrey knows that. But I think it generates some conversation we need to have. And one thing you brought up at the tail end of the last segment was, you know, the fact that what is it going to look like in 10 years or 20 years? And there's so many factors involved. But just considering the political, you know, the political tension that exists and is likely as has existed for a while. And is likely to continue, you know, what do you think it looks like in 10 or 20 years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we'll just continue to live under illiberalism or semi-authoritarianism, where we have minimal freedoms, and we'll live like most people have lived in presidential republics. We don't have a form of government. We don't have a form of voting. And we don't have a constitution that can fix the problem we have. I as I say these words, I feel like I can hear Thomas Jefferson clapping, because whatever one wants to say about the founders of this country, they did understand that what they were writing was for 1789, and that there was a right of revolt and an obligation to change a government if it didn't work that was in the Constitution. And I can't imagine that many of those people would have thought that it's 2025 and we would be living under the same system.
So, I mean, a lot of people will blame Donald Trump for the drift into authoritarianism. Do you blame Donald Trump, or do you see that drift going back?
No, further? No. In fact, no, it's been going on for several decades. And really, the most significant differences in our country is really the outsized power that money has, and that big money has, in terms of buying politicians, in terms of writing our laws, in terms of the enforcement of our laws, in terms of, and so it is significant that one of our political parties is, when you do comparative government analysis, is somewhere in between the conservative parties in the UK and Canada and Erdogan's party or United Russia, that it has given up on the American
experiment.
You're
saying the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, it's anti-intellectual, it's anti-science, it's openly authoritarian in terms of endorsing political violence, in terms of not subscribing to one person, one vote, suppressing the vote, state after state.
Well, and
in fact, even publicly saying, in some, at least when they're honest, that, you know, maybe everybody shouldn't even have the right to vote, et cetera, you know. And I mean, and part of what I say with this proposal is, you know, really, we've reached a point in this country where, you know, one side says 2 + 2 = 4, the other side says 2 + 2 = 5. And, you know, at a certain point, you really don't want to argue with people that say 2 + 2 = 5. You just want to say that's fine. But say 2 + 2 = 5 and live in that alternate universe somewhere else, you know, and. I think really that's where we're at. Everybody's in their vacuums.
No matter where you vacuums. Live. I mean, we live in a neighborhood that is primarily Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got a good friend in this neighborhood who voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
We get together for dinner sometimes. We get along just fine.
Sure.
We have another neighbor who has gone so far as to have a Trump sign. Actually, two Trump signs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really comfortable to talk politics with them because it's basically just
sure.
just right-wing radio talking points. You know, there's nothing original coming out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a nice guy. Why would sure. I not want to have a nice guy as a neighbor, even if he disagrees on politics? Why does he have to move across the river?
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he would choose to live with you, or maybe he would choose to live with people like you. Maybe if push came to shove and people had to decide where they were going to live, it could get interesting, to be honest with you. And, you know, there may be some Democrats or so-called Democrats or, you know, people in the center left, whatever, center who might go live on the other side. But I don't really think that is the issue. I mean, people can get along and work with one another in illiberal countries. Shoot, they could get along and live with each other in, you know, late 1930s, early 1940s Germany, and be neighbors. And
for a while.
Yeah.
To a point.
Yeah,
depending on who you were.
Well, yeah, but I mean, once the bombs start dropping on Berlin, everybody sort of, you know, rallies around one another, no matter their background. You know, I don't think that is really the issue. I think from a larger macro perspective of a constitution that is nearly impossible to change, two-thirds House of Representatives, two-thirds of the Senate, three-quarters of the States.
That's not impossible. That's just difficult.
It's happened 17 times. Well, I know,
it's already happened a lot.
Yeah, it can be vetoed. Well, it hasn't happened a lot.
How many amendments do we have?
17.
Yeah, okay, so that's a lot. And we repealed one of them.
Since 1789, the average life of a constitution is 17 years. You know, and one of the reasons ours has lasted forever is because it's impossible to change. I mean,
not impossible, just difficult.
Okay, 4% of the population has a veto over so 96% of the U.S. population based in states could agree on a constitutional amendment to, let's say, take money out of elections, and only 4%, the number of senators in small states, could veto it. Because when you're talking about three-quarters of the states, you know, understand that, and you know, I know you understand this, that some of these states are extremely small. So, you know, it's the same thing we have with the Senate.
Right. Why does Rhode Island have the same voting clout as Texas?
Absolutely. Yeah. And almost nobody around the world has a Senate that is set up as undemocratically. I mean, so far away from the idea. Part of what I'm saying is the best a presidential republic can do is majority rule and protect the minority. Mm-hmm. We have a form of government now in part because of the rural-urban divide. It's not the Republican Party's fault per se. They've just been able to capitalize on the fact that the Senate and the Electoral College give a dramatic advantage to small rural states.
Well, and then plenty of other, you know, election malfeasance as well. Gerrymandering, different laws that, for example, a silly law that you prevents you from handing out water or food to people waiting in long lines at polling places in Georgia. I mean, things like that. I mean, the election laws across the country are riddled with ridiculous prohibitive measures that make it difficult to vote. Why not fix all that? I mean, so let's argue. Let's say, Jeffrey, that the coin is flipped. Democrats get to move to California. Republicans get to move to the other side of the river. Not just California.
We'll start all over,
I guess, you know, Democrats get to move to Iowa on west. Mm-hmm. What does that migration look like? I mean, I think about the partition of India back in 1947. All the areas with a Muslim majority got to be Pakistan. There was East Pakistan and West Pakistan, and of mm-hmm. course, East Pakistan became Bangladesh.
Bangladesh, yeah.
But it was a horrible situation where people were uprooted from their homes, and millions of people would die. They were both Hindu and Muslim, died, murdered, children killed, fired. I mean, things torched. Right. It was terrible.
Yeah.
Why would we not expect a similar?
This doesn't need to happen.
Here?
I mean, right now, when you look at opinion polls. You know, and this has been for a while, one of our parties has a more favorable view of, let's say, Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un than they do of, let's say, Hillary Clinton. So really, this does not need to be violent. And yes, you know, East Pakistan becoming Bangladesh, and we know that was very violent in the late 1940s. But over time, Bangladesh is Bangladesh, and India is India, and, you know, the two haven't been at war.
Pakistan is...
Pakistan
and India don't get along.
No, they don't.
Never. And so here's what I'm thinking.
They both have nuclear weapons.
And both sides. Where do the nuclear weapons go?
That will all have to be worked out.
Right. So both sides are going to have nuclear weapons. It's going to be like India and Pakistan, with the Mississippi River, the dividing.
That will all have to be worked out. I mean, and I'm not saying that's a small thing to be worked out. I guess what I would say for people who don't think this makes sense. What is your solution for majority rule, for the reality that on the core issues of the day, both the Republican base and the Democratic base agree. And at the same time, there isn't a mechanism for those masses of the people to get what they want through normal constitutional procedures, through normal voting procedures. And whether you are Republican or Democrat in those bases, the public in the United States understands that money has extraordinary power, and corporations are people, money is speech. And if you can't have a constitutional amendment to change that, how does this all change? And I guess that's what I would pose to people. I think it's time to start anew.
I'll be your first respondent. Well, I'm probably not your first respondent, but I said, okay, so I advocate marriage counseling instead of a divorce. And in that counseling conversation, we talk about, well, what needs to change to make things functional? Instead of just, I mean, if it gets to the point where we can't figure out what to change, then yeah, we split up. But that's extreme. To me, figure out what to do with two separate countries, both that have nuclear weapons, one that's somehow Republican, one that's somehow Democrat. I don't know how that works without a civil war that's going to make the previous civil war look like a walk in the park. So to me, it's a lot easier to change the U.S. Senate, do away with the U.S., maybe not do away with it, but make it proportional, you know, based on vote, like the House. The House is based on population. Make the Senate based on population as well. Do away with, I mean, put some big checks and balances on money in politics.
Okay.
Do away with Citizens United.
Okay.
Instant runoff voting. You know, some of these reforms.
Yeah. So as long as you can persuade the two parties and the corporations that give money to the two parties
that control them
to have a two-thirds vote in the Senate, a two-thirds vote in the House, and three-quarters of the state to ratify it, it's not going to happen. I mean, all of the ideas that you're talking about are a lot of times in the back of political science books for like what we do now. And those things have a likelihood of, I don't know, 1 in 10,500. I mean, what are your odds? So this is the only way that I can see, at least in a thought experiment, that we could move. In other words, the polarization is too great right now, and the institutions that we have cannot you know, solve the conflict that we have the way it is currently set up. I mean, if you were to ask probably almost anybody in the United States, how would you like to have proportional representation voting, multiple parties, you get 10% of the vote, you get 10% of the seats. I think almost everybody would agree with you. But both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party don't want that.
I have seen that. When I offered common sense election reforms at the state level as a lawmaker, I had a Republican that agreed to sponsor amendments with me, and I had the ranking member, the leading party member of the state government committee, both parties, Democrat Republican, shot it down.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And we got a handful of votes, but not much. So I know what you're saying.
Oh yeah, because the two parties, you know, in part benefit from this. You know, they can have a monopoly if they're in California, and then, you know, the other party has a monopoly if they're in Iowa. And so we are staring at a one-party state at a national level, and I think we'll be probably doing that for a long time.
No, really? You don't think Democrats are going to gain the House back in 2026?
It won't matter, because with the filibuster, any substantive legislation...
Filibuster in the House. You're talking about the Senate.
The filibuster in the Senate, because any substantive legislation that would be passed in the House will be filibustered in the Senate.
But the
Even if the Democrats control the Senate, you need 60 votes in the Senate.
But a Democratic Senate is going to block a bunch of stuff.
Another
from
veto.
Right?
What's that?
A Democratic House, rather, could block a lot of stuff from happening.
A few things.
Okay.
They can do oversight, and they'll do a lot of oversight, is mostly what they'll do. But in the end, even if the Democrats were to take the House and the Senate, the minority party would filibuster nearly everything. The only thing they couldn't filibuster is some budget bills and some cabinet appointments and you know.
So,
but anything substantial, you know, related to other things, it'll just be filibustered. Filibuster is just another one of those mechanisms that most countries don't have. It's fundamentally anti-democratic, and there doesn't seem to be a way to let it go.
I think there is. is universal agreement, not universal, but overwhelming agreement that things need to change. And I, you know, part of the problem is these reforms don't get prioritized in elections. And so you have, they end up getting ignored. And the, again, like you said, the partisan, the special interests that control the parties don't want to see them addressed. But anyway, Jeffrey, we could talk about this for a long. You and I ought to have a public debate on this. We ought to sell tickets.
Yeah.
Well,
if nothing else, and I think your audience can tell that, I mean, it's a thought piece. It's just to get us thinking and, in the Jeffersonian tradition.
Yeah. Well, Thomas Jefferson, if he was here today, you'd think he'd be clapping for you. I think he'd be stopping his foot. No, maybe not.
I think he'd probably look at us both like we're both crazy.
Maybe that. Yeah.